she was.
All rise. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, draw nigh and give your attention, for this court is now in session. God save the United States and its honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning, I'm Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Lance. To my left is Judge Davis. We're here today for the matter of Cavarez versus Peek with a docket number of 080548. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Good morning, Your Honors. Landon Overby for the appellant, Mr. Cavarez, and joining me at counsel's table is Zachary Stoles.
Thank you.
Good morning, Judges. Richard Meerick for the Secretary. Seated at counsel table with me is Gabriel Clemens, paralegal in our office.
Thank you. Welcome. Both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present their respective arguments. Mr. Overby, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Your Honor, thank you. I would like to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please.
You have it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. We believe this Court has jurisdiction over this appeal. But I'd like to begin this morning to address the question that was answered in the Court's supplemental briefing order to Mr. Cavarez as well as to the Secretary. The question in particular is whether the document filed by Mr. Cavarez constitutes an NOA and whether the Secretary or the Board had a duty to liberally construe that document as received by the Board of Veterans' Appeals to see if it was an NOA or a notice of appeal. Interestingly, the question is pretty much answered by the Court's decision in Henderson. However, to answer this particular question in a sense of a hypothetical, could have the Board construed the document as a notice of appeal, we would submit that the answer is yes. Should have the Board construed that as a notice of appeal, the answer is yes. The outcome, should they and could have they interpreted that as a actual notice of appeal, they could have sent it to the Court, but they did not. Instead, they sent it.
On what basis, looking at that document, would anyone think it's a notice of appeal?
Your Honor, I believe it's a notice of appeal because, one, it indicates at the top, although inartfully worded, notice of disagreement. It talks about the decision that the Board made dealing with the gastrectomy. There was only one single issue in that particular decision. He asserted why he believed that he was, why the Board's decision was wrong, included his name, his address.
But why would anyone think it's an intent to seek judicial review of this Court?
Under a liberal construction.
Liberally construing it. Show me anything in this document, anything surrounding the circumstances that would make anyone think that there's an intent to seek appeal in this court.
Your Honor, I believe that just basically looking at the issue of the very heading of it saying notice of disagreement, and like I said, inartfully worded.
Well, okay, put it up to your head and tell me what it should have said.
I'm sorry?
Sorry. I'm just tell me what in this document shows an indicia, an intent to seek judicial review in this court. I mean, it's obvious that he disagrees with the Board decision.
That is correct.
Okay. Where's an intent to seek review in this court?
There is nothing specifically in this particular document.
All right. Surrounding circumstances. It was not filed here, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. So do you have anything that shows an intent to seek review in this court?
Not with this particular document, no, Your Honor.
Then with what do you have? If it's not in this particular document, are you suggesting there's something else that might show an intent to seek an appeal in this court?
Your Honor, we believe this court has jurisdiction, and I'll explain why. This document, as we alluded to in both our opening supplemental brief as well as our reply supplemental brief, is that it should have been construed, which begs the question from the court's order, should have been construed as a motion for reconsideration.
All right, I'll stop there. We may get there. My first question is, is there anything in this or the surrounding circumstances that would indicate that the appellant at that time on the date filed was seeking judicial review in the court? Anything?
There's nothing in this particular document that says judicial.
So your alternative argument is that this is a request for reconsideration?
That would be correct, Your Honor.
And why?
I'm sorry?
Why is it a request for reconsideration?
Well, it includes the same similar type of requirements. It was mailed to the Board of Veterans' Appeals specifically, and it was even received by the Director of Admin Services at the Board of Veterans' Appeals. Indicates a disagreement, sets forth why the veteran believed that the board's decision was incorrect. Includes the only thing that is missing from this document is the date of the decision. But the board should be able to ascertain whether or not by looking at this particular document, not too long after the Board of Veterans Appeals' decision, that it is a motion for reconsideration. So by looking
at... And is the board required to liberally construe documents filed with them?
Your Honor, I believe it is.
And you cited too?
I believe the...
Doesn't the regulation require?
I'm sorry?
Do their regulations require it?
A liberal construction? No, Your Honor. There's nothing. But I believe that the court's case law dealing with construction of notices of disagreement as well as substantive appeals, that it would apply to the same standard when it comes to a motion for reconsideration. The only difference here is the thing that was left out was the actual date of the decision, but I think the board could have ascertained what the veteran was seeking. And in that regard, the board, instead of actually doing anything with a document as a reconsideration, determined and forwarded that particular document to the regional office, or actually two different regional offices from what we've gathered. And that one was the Providence, Rhode Island regional office, as well as the Montgomery, Alabama regional office. But by doing so, the reason why this court has jurisdiction concerning that, if the court believes and interprets this document to be an actual motion for reconsideration, then the Federal Circuit's decision in DeShotto seems to have some sort of implication here, in the sense that because the board didn't actually send a veteran a letter saying we've denied this, sent it to the regional office just for mere do something with this particular document, that it was deemed denied. And whenever Mr. Kavars filed his appeal within 120 days, otherwise February 14th, I believe, or 15th, 2008, then it should have been considered within the 120-day period of time.
So your suggestion now is that we have a deemed denial by the board for reconsideration, and that this was filed up here, even after that, and therefore it constitutes a notice of appeal.
It could be construed that way, Your Honor. It's either that way or it's a motion for reconsideration that the board has yet to act on.
Go ahead.
Mr. Overby, I was tracking you until you got into sub silentio denials and the Schodel and a few other problems there. But basically, it took the VA about a month to figure out what they were going to do with this instrument. I believe they forwarded it or provided notice to your client about a month after they received the document that he should appeal to this court.
That is correct, Your Honor.
About a 30-day period. And without getting into the concept of equitable estoppel, is there any theory that can be built from that 30-day period?
In the sense of a theory as to what someone should have done, I'm not sure I'm following your question.
Well, you know, it seems to me that they were trying to discern what it is that they had in their possession. It took them 30 days. They returned it to the RO. At some point, they decided to advise your client to appeal to this court if he intended that to be an appeal. So that 30-day period was one that bothers me a little bit. I'm not sure what to do with it. I don't think we want to go down the road of equitable estoppel, but I thought possibly you had some theory you could offer or advance.
Your Honor, I think, and there's the case law, the history of equitable tolling and Henderson, Bowles, but I'd like to look at the Federal Circuit's decision in Bailey, and they reference an M21 provision that VA employees are supposed to handle correspondence within a rapid period of time. I think they said 10 days in Bailey. And I looked prior to oral argument in the M21 provisions, though that no longer exists. But here, the Board of Veterans Appeals received Mr. Kovaris' document, I believe, on October 12th or October 5th as the date stamp. Then 19 days later, which clearly would be outside the 10-day window according to that M21 provision in Bailey, no one acted on that particular document. They did eventually act on that document, send it to two different regional offices, where notably that on that form, the Board of Veterans' Appeals, who knows that their decisions are being reviewed by this court, should have the instinct to actually look at a particular document and determine, instead of having the generic boxes, there's a box at the very bottom of the page that was submitted with our appendix that says other. They could have easily sent it to the court, but they did not. Then it gets sent to the regional office, and it is troubling because the regional office receives it, I believe, on November 5th. They didn't act for another 9 days in doing so. They clearly construed it as an intent to appeal to this court, notified the veteran on the 120th day, but failed. They could have picked up the telephone. There, in light of the court's decision in Henderson, I'm not sure how we get around the I think it was bound by that, unless this court were to convene en banc. However, I'm aware that the court's decision in Henderson has been appealed to the Federal Circuit. It is indeed troubling. What happened and transpired is similar to what happened in a case that was argued last month in Boone, just where the veteran filed it. This Mr. Kovars filed his at the Board of Veterans' Appeals. Mr. Boone had filed his at the regional office.
Wasn't there a big difference between the Boone case and this one? In the Boone case, didn't the filing below talk about the court, talk about an appeal?
I don't recall the specific facts, Your Honor, but I do recall that in that particular case, his document was filed with the regional office, and Mr. Kovars' was filed with the board. But at some point, some regional office personnel, whether it was an adjudicator, whether it was a clerical person.
Did you take a look at Elsevier?
I have, Your Honor.
Did you take from that case that equitable tolling is one possibility, now not permitted under Henderson, but that a constructive filing might be another view?
I took from Elsevier
would be my guess, but I'm not sure.
But I took from that decision two things. One was that the court at that time indicated that whenever the Board of Veterans' Appeals received that document, it must have been filed with the court, not the Board of Veterans' Appeals. But two, that equitable tolling could possibly exist in certain circumstances. But I learned as well that shortly thereafter, either a year or two.
Well, didn't they review the processing under three? One was a constructive filing possibility, and they rejected it. And the other, a separate legal theory, was equitable tolling. And then I think equitable estoppel might have been the third one. But my question really focuses around if this panel is precluded from considering equitable tolling, are we also precluded from considering constructive filing because that had been decided in Sevier, and that portion has not been through the ringer as equitable tolling has.
Your Honor, I don't think, with respect to that, I don't think the constructive filing has been. I think it exists because of the Federal Circuit's decision in Santana Venegas.
Now, even though they put it under the umbrella of equitable tolling, it might still exist separately.
Again, Your Honors, I have to be with all candor and just admit that what has happened in the last couple of years dealing with equitable tolling, John R. Sand and Gravel, the Federal Circuit's decision en banc in Kirkendall, which was petitioned for cert, was denied, which even Kirkendall relied on the Federal Circuit's decision in Bailey. So I think there is a kind of an open air as to where equitable tolling stands, especially in the arena of the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims and the statutory command under 7266.
Well, Counselor, I think Bowles is fairly clear, at least it is to me. And without having to debate that with you, I guess. It seems to me that what we're all grappling with is when a veteran receives adequate notice. If you disagree with our decision, you have 120 days in which to file here. Okay. And I'm unaware of any court that I'm familiar with generally, as a general rule, waiving their jurisdictional requirements, their filing mandate times. And I'm curious as to why this court, of all of the courts in the United States, should be the one that says, yeah, you can go ahead and misfile or you can miss dates. And somehow we're the ones that are going to allow you to do that when no one else is. And I know sympathetic reading and veterans and so forth and so on, but I guess my point is that it seems to me the Supreme Court was very pointed in the Bowles decision, which was a capital case, as you're aware.
Yes.
I can't imagine, and a judge misinforming someone about filing time, I can't imagine a circumstance that's any more blatant in terms of trying to make the point that we're not going to wrestle with this concept of equitable tolling much anymore. So, having said all that, I'm just curious as to why you think, or if you think, we should start going down that road again or trying to.
Well, Your Honor, I think after having reviewed the decisions, especially the Supreme Court's decision in Bowles, but more importantly this court's decision in Henderson, as well as John R. Sand and Gravel, the thing that was the focus of the Supreme Court's decision was the timeliness issue. The jurisdictional is the timeliness requirement. Here we're talking of a 120-day period within which the veteran has to file the notice of appeal. The particular aspect of with the court, I'm well aware of that, but just as in Houston v. Lack, they looked at the terminology filed, and in doing so, the filed, and I admit that looking at two different statutes, the statute in Houston v. Lack actually didn't have with the court language, but the court could possibly, in some sense, take that and say, Mr. Kovaris actually filed within 120 days. He did misfile it. If Santana Venegas and Bailey actually still continue on as good law, then there's nothing that this court is actually creating anew. So long as in Henderson, it was filed outside of the 120 days. Here, we are within 120 days, I believe approximately 90, 95 days.
Mr. Overby, good morning.
Good morning.
If this document is construed as a motion for reconsideration to the board, which I think is a fair construction, when I look at the phrase in the document, being the above named veteran, I wish to file this notice of disagreement with the Department of Veterans Affairs Board of Veterans Appeals. You can't get much clearer than that.
Sure.
But if this is a motion filed with the board in a timely fashion, as you indicate, what would that do to our jurisdiction?
Again, I think if I can backtrack to what I was explaining earlier, there's two different methods to look at this. Either the board has not acted on the document, or if you're following the Federal Circuit's decision in DeShotto, well, if they have not acted on it, then under Cerullo, I believe it's Cerullo or Rosler, the court would have to dismiss this so the board could actually consider whether or not reconsideration should be granted. In the alternative, however, what I believe the court could do in this particular case is actually look at it because of the fact that the board determined when they received the document, they were fully aware of it. I'm sure they read the contents. They sent it to two different regional offices that under DeShotto that it was deemed denied. And therefore, because if it is deemed denied and this court were to find that it was deemed denied, then within that 120-day period from when it's deemed denied, starting on November 1st, 2007, when Mr. Kovaris actually, let me say, when the court received Mr. Kovaris' notice of appeal on February 14th or 15th of 2008, it was clearly within the 120-day time frame to give this court jurisdiction.
But do you know, isn't it the board chairman who decides on reconsideration?
It is the board chairman
Did
or
the board chairman make a decision and forward it down to the regional office? I mean, do you have a document from the board chairman sending it to the regional Isn't it more likely that administratively it came in, they saw a notice of disagreement on top, you think regional office, and they sent it to the regional office?
Your Honor, I can't speculate on that, but with respect to the board chairman does not actually rule on every particular motion for reconsideration. He has designees.
Do you have other designees from the board chairman who forwarded this to the regional office?
I'm sorry?
Do you have a document showing that the board chairman or his designee forwarded this to the regional office?
No, but by analogy, just similar to what DeShottle dealt with in a claim that was actually filed, actually two claims, one was actually addressed.
I like your theory, don't get me wrong, but I don't think you have, I mean, you'd have to take a lot of jumps to say that this is a deemed denial. It's quite a different than the Federal Circuit's deemed denial of a decision of the board that at least included some reference to what was being denied, that it's all denied, to saying that a forwarding from the board to the regional office without any indicia that it was the board chairman or his designee is now a deemed denial by the board chairman or his specifically designated person. But it's a good theory. I like it.
I just believe, Your Honor, that whenever the board actually returned it to the regional office, it was...
But if this is deemed a filing below within the 120-day period, and we had no jurisdiction and dismissed it for that, the end result would be that it would be within the board's province. If they don't proceed with it, you can come back with a mandamus. If they do proceed with it, you'll get a decision, and then your client would have 120 days to file an appeal. Is that correct?
That would be correct, Your Honor.
Let me just add one other follow-up question, Mr. Overby. I don't hear you arguing that either the Board of Veterans' Appeals or the regional office would be agents of this court, this Article I court, not a part of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Is that correct?
I'm relying on what we've argued on our pleadings, but in looking at this as well, I think that in a sense from what the Board of Veterans Appeals did in this particular case, I think they had a duty to assist, and I say assist not in the terms of 5103 Big A, but just as they forwarded to the regional office, they had some sort of obligation to, they could have instead sent it to the court and fulfilled that assistance to the veteran, but they failed to do so. So in the sense of that agent, they could have assisted the court in that regard.
Time is up unless you have another question. Let's add 2 minutes to the time, please.
The penumbral shades of the duty to assist, as I recall, some constitutional law. Thank you.
Then we will not add the 2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. The only question properly before the court today is whether or not it received notice of appeal within the 120-day period. The facts in this case are undisputed. The court did not physically receive it until after the 120-day period. There are no equitable exceptions to that time period, and the court should dismiss the case. We can talk all day about circumstances surrounding how the court finally got this notice of appeal, but they are not relevant in light of Bowles and Henderson and that bright line jurisdictional rule.
Aren't Bowles and Henderson distinguishable, though, as your opposing counsel suggested, that they both involved a late filing period anywhere, and this involves, except for a second, that this could in some way, shape, or form constitute a notice of appeal for discussion purposes, filed down with the board. Wouldn't that present a different case than Bowles and Henderson, because there was a filing of a notice of appeal? Again, we're accepting that this would constitute that.
Your Honor, I believe the import of Bowles was that we have to look at the congressionally mandated statute. Congress has been clear with the jurisdictional statute 7266 for this court.
But doesn't that say it has to be filed within 120 days?
At this court, it does, Your Honor.
And what happens if the 120th day falls on a Sunday?
I would presume it would push over to the next working day of this court.
So it's not exactly absolute, is it?
Well, I think it is, Your Honor. I think it's a a long accepted legal doctrine that if it falls on a holiday, a filing due date is falls on a holiday, then it gets pushed to the next day that the court is in session.
What about the fact that the Supreme Court has taken the statutory provisions and allowed a prisoner to file with the warden and deem that to be a filing with the warden? And what about the fact that the federal rules of appellate procedure have misfilings at the appellate court that are deemed to be filed in the district court? What about the 28 U.S.C., forgive me, I don't know the number off the top of my head, that says a filing in one court can be deemed a filing in another court on the date filed? We're not in that particular list because it was put in the statutes before we were created. But clearly it seems to me that there's a long-standing acceptance of misfilings being dated as filed in that court, even though it was filed somewhere else. Okay. So why isn't that one of those exceptions?
I believe the examples you've provided are covered in federal rules of procedure, Your Honor. We have no such exceptions in the jurisdictional statute for this court. We cannot look beyond the statute for this court.
Could we put an exception in our rule?
No, Your Honor. I mean, you could put the exception, but you cannot expand your jurisdiction.
When Congress created this court, didn't they first say that the interim rules of this court were the federal rules of appellate procedure?
Yes, for an, as an interim.
And wouldn't that have included a misfiling, the fact that those rules included the concept of misfiling?
At that time, perhaps it would have, Your Honor, but they were an interim rule because it was a brand new court until you got up and running, and then you...
But wouldn't that be judicial, congressional acceptance of the fact that perhaps this court could issue its own rules that had guidance with regard to misfilings?
No, Your Honor. Not in today's world. This court, if I've read it once, I've read it 10,000 times. This court's jurisdiction is defined by statute, and this court cannot expand or extend that jurisdiction. And frankly, that's where we are now.
Aren't we even beyond that? Let's be frank. Do you see any indicia, any indication on this document that there was an intent to seek an appeal at this court?
No, Your Honor.
So even if there was a duty to assist, as counsel suggested, even if there were some duties out there, even if it had accepted the filing down below, the Secretary's position, I presume, is that this is not a notice of appeal.
I could argue that for the Secretary, Your Honor. We have not argued that. We have taken appellant at his word where he has indicated in his pleadings to this court more than once this was intended to be a notice of appeal. We're not going to contest that. If that was his intent, it very well could be, and we don't have a problem with that. Congress has clearly stated the conditions under which an appellant can get into this court. To understand the gravamen of the Bowles bright line rule, Judge Lance is absolutely correct with the facts of the Bowles case, with the highly protective individual freedom in that case, and the district court providing the false time period. If there were ever going to be a time to consider equitable considerations, it was a case such as that.
Well, Counselor, referring to Judge Castle's line of questioning, I think, it appears that it took the VA about 30 days to be precise, a little longer than 30 days, to figure out what it was they were going to call this instrument. They received it. They forwarded it to the RO and said, "What is this?" Forwarded to the RO, and the date that the 120 days expired, November 14, 2007, they write a letter to the appellant and they say, "We think that this is probably intended as an appeal to the court and you need to file it with the court," in a letter, November 14, 2007, I believe. Now, I'm certain that all of that is coincidental, but because it was the 120th day, it would have, it has the appearance of running out the clock on somebody, and I'm sure that was not intended. But my point is, for 30 some days, the VA had possession of this instrument that they were trying to figure out what it was, and then ultimately decided to call it an appeal on the 120th day. Now, that I find troublesome. Do you have any comments or thoughts on
that? Your Honor, there are several things. I don't know that it's the department that named this an appeal. The RO thought that's what it was when it received it. The RO told the appellant within 10 days of the RO receiving this that they thought it was an appeal. He never said, no, that's not what it was intended to be. He never responded that it was intended to be something else. In the pleadings to this court, he's never said that it was intended to be anything else. He's always said the intent was this is to be a notice of appeal. This is a similar thing that occurred in Elsevier that the court had us take a look at. It was a misfiling of an NOA at the board there. The board did nothing with it for 30 days. There is no duty for the board to do anything, and I know this gives you, Judge, great concern. In this case, I would probably agree with Judge Kasold that a clerk received this at the board among many, many, many thousands of pleadings, saw a notice of disagreement, said notice of disagreements are handled at the RO. By the time they got to it, they sent it to the RO. The RO looked at it and said, look, there's nothing to disagree with as far as an NOD is concerned. You must have intended this to be an appeal, and you need to file it with the court. There is absolutely no duty. Congress, just as it has defined an appellant's duties in order to gain access to this court, and you almost keep wanting to flip the duties, the responsibilities, the burden onto the department for filing an appeal to this court. The duties, the burden is on the appellant, not on the department to file an appeal to this court. Just as Congress has defined his burden and how to accomplish an appeal to this court, Congress has also defined what the board is to do when it decides an appeal, or when it decides a claim. It is supposed to give an appellant notice of what his responsibilities are to get a review of that denial. And they do that in 5104. Following 5104, with every BVA decision, the department sends VA Form 4597 out, laying out and making it very clear that it's not, the department has no duties, it's not going to assist. Everything in there is addressed or in reference to the appellant. It says you have to do this, you have to do that. You, and it specifically says that the appellant, it is your responsibility to make sure that your appeal to the court is filed on time. And that's in italics, Your Honor. It also says, to ensure full protection of your right of appeal to the court, you must file your notice of appeal with the court, not with the board or any other VA office. We've satisfied the department satisfied its congressional mandate of what its duties are.
Mr. Meyer, good morning.
Good morning.
If the appellant intended the notice of disagreement to basically be a notice of disagreement with the Veterans Affairs Board of Appeals decision, and in essence a motion for reconsideration, what is your position on that prospect?
Your Honor, the Secretary doesn't care. All the Secretary wants the appellant, who is here today, is to tell us. He's told us all along it's intended to be a notice of appeal. If he'd like to change his position and rather say, no, this is a motion or a motion for BVA reconsideration, that's fine. I would ask him to withdraw his appeal to this court then, and I will personally make sure that this motion for reconsideration gets in front of the chairman or his designate, just let us know what it is. Don't throw this red herring out at the last part of your supplemental memorandum, not even saying that this was, that's what this was intended to be, but just implying that maybe it could be. It's one thing or it's another. He's already...
In fairness, as I understand the filings, the veteran was unrepresented, got representation, and all that they had at the time for counsel was the letter from the RO, which is the first indication that anyone might have thought it was an appeal. And there's nothing in the record, we don't have a big record, to indicate, but just looking at it, you have a veteran who filed below, looks at a document, says, board, disagreement, reconsideration, strikes at you. You have a letter from the regional office saying, hey, you really should file this at the court, almost VA telling the veteran that, forget about reconsideration, it's not an issue, you have an appeal. Counsel gets it, immediately files because of the timeliness requirements, and then when he gets the claims file, according to his footnote, says, oh, by the way, I think this might be a request for reconsideration. So my question to you is, did you guys talk in the last few weeks about in the same manner that you just represented to the court? Because...
Well, off the record, Your Honor, of course, is after the...
All right, well, we don't need to go any further, but that's the type of thing that perhaps can be settled before it even gets here.
Your Honor, we did talk.
All right.
It's the Secretary's position that when the court looks beyond the question of whether it physically received, and in a way within the 120-day appeal period, it is opening a door to the rule to a room that the Supreme Court has not given it access. And that is the room full of excuses for whatever happened that caused an NOA not to be timely filed. In all my experience in dealing with several jurisdictional cases in our office, I've never seen an excuse that wasn't based on equitable considerations. And I can't, I'm a man of limited intelligence and imagination, but I can't imagine one that wouldn't be based on equitable considerations. Henderson said that Bowles held there are no equitable considerations.
Counsel, is there any theory to your, that you're aware of that puts the regional office or the board in the shoes of agents of this Article I court?
No, Your Honor. There's absolutely no authority for that. This is an independent court, and it would be antithetical to in any way even indicate that the department could be an agent of this court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Before we let you go, I'll ask your opposing counsel if you would agree to get together and let the court know if there's a resolution before proceeding with an opinion being rendered. Would you agree to do that? If
your
opposing counsel
is
agreeable, thank you.
Your Honors, briefly, I would just like to address one thing, and I would. This isn't just a matter of the Secretary agreeing to consider a motion for reconsideration. Ultimately, the veteran wants jurisdiction, regardless if he's made the argument of whether it's a notice of appeal, whether it's a motion for reconsideration, notice of disagreement, some quasi-terminology to get this court to review his case. Ultimately, he believes that the Board of Veterans Appeals has done wrong by him. He wants this court's jurisdiction.
There are procedures to follow.
Sir.
And you need to file an appeal with the court.
I understand.
And an appeal with the court came over 120 days. Clearly, if this were filed within the 120 days up here, we wouldn't be here. It wasn't. It was filed below. And so you have an issue as to whether or not representation from the Secretary that perhaps you guys can discuss processing this as a notice of disagreement, and ultimately you can get the resolution for your client. Or you cannot do that and let the court know and we'll proceed.
Certainly. We've represented in our reply brief, and I'm more than happy to do so if the court would permit. And if the court wants to set a particular time frame, as we indicated, 15 days in our
I don't think we need to set that. I think it's very clear. Either we can render a decision, and who knows what that might be, but it could be that we don't have jurisdiction, and then you can proceed down below, and if the board doesn't take it, you can come back with a mandamus. You don't need 15 days. You can make an agreement with the secretary now, and then we don't have to get into the process of writing a decision. So by the end of the day, I think you can let the clerk know if there's an agreement or not. Is that agreeable with the panel?
Your Honors, I will attempt to contact the client immediately following the oral argument.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Do we have anything else? The case will be withheld until we hear from the clerk. I just made that up. I have no idea.
At least you didn't dismiss me.
That's true.
That's true. I've done that before. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge. Good to see you, Judge.
The Honorable Court is adjourned to further order.